It's a great honor to say that joining me in the studio today is Hakeem Adi, a professor of the history of Africa and African diaspora from Chichester University. His research interests Pan-Africanism to the modern political history of Africa. He was a founder member of the Black and Asian Studies Association, and he also leads the History Matters group. His works include West Africans in Britain from 1900 to 1960, and Pan-Africanism and Communism. He has also worked on the multi-award-winning documentary, 500 Years Later. Professor, many thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
My first question then relates to the position that many African nations find themselves in, namely highly indebted to richer nations and global financial institutions. Can you give our viewers a brief introduction as to how African nations found themselves in this position?
Well, I think the easiest way of understanding that is to think about the colonial period and the kind of economies that most African countries had during that period. And the fact is that even though we're 60 or 70 years after most African countries gained independence, their economies are still geared to generally producing products for export, raw materials of various kinds for export. They're still highly dependent on global markets. They're still highly dependent on an economy which is skewed against them and operates in the favor of the big powers, the G20 countries and others. Many of them are in debt for a variety of reasons. They needed to borrow to produce and develop infrastructural developments of various kinds. And so they're really in a dependent situation with the major economies of the world, the economies of the EU, the US, and other major powers.
Okay, next up then, with the current global coronavirus pandemic having such a devastating effect on the people of the world, how then are nations in Africa coping with the virus? And when it comes to paying back debt, are the lenders giving enough space to African nations to concentrate on dealing with the pandemic as a priority over debt repayment?
Well, I think you could say that most African countries have probably dealt with the COVID pandemic better than some of the wealthier countries. If we think of countries like the US and Britain that haven't coped very well, most African countries, with one or two exceptions, have far fewer cases of the virus and far fewer deaths. Having said that, they still need to apportion some of their budgets to health and other programs of that kind, and so many of them are still struggling. Some have to decide between debt repayments and spending more on health and other forms of social care. So there's still a problem. There have been some efforts by the big lenders, by G20 and others, to mitigate the circumstances regarding debt payments, but for a variety of reasons, most African countries haven't taken up those offers.
And finally, what does the future hold for African nations in a post-pandemic period? As we have seen, there is much interest from nations such as China when it comes to investing in Africa. Is this something that Africa should embrace or, in fact, should be wary of?
I think Africa should be very wary of it. Again, it all depends on the relationship between African countries and lenders. And if that relationship is one of dependency, it's not really a good thing for African countries. It also, of course, depends on what these investments are for, what African governments are borrowing for. But generally, these kinds of arrangements tend to keep Africa's economies dependent on other countries, whether those are the countries of the West, so-called, the EU, the US, or big emerging powers like China.
Many thanks, Professor Adi from the University of Chichester. It's been great having you on the show.
You're welcome anytime.
We're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere, as we have plenty more coming. We're joined by researcher and journalist Atefeh Padidar as she runs us through some of her findings on the topic from the world of social media. We also delve into the global pandemic and ascertain just how bad things are in developing nations around the world, as well as examining whether foreign direct investment is a benefit or a burden to developing nations. So Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
We've already touched on the notion that the coronavirus has caused one of the world's worst financial collapses in history, with a real possibility of a global depression on the cards for many nations, and for those that are lucky, maybe just a prolonged recession. But for nations in the global south and still in development, how has the impact of the virus affected them? For a start, with the notion of existing debt hanging over their shoulders, tough choices have had to be made, namely, the choice between paying back debt or paying towards its internal infrastructure, particularly in the field of healthcare, to be able to provide much-needed services to the sick and needy. For many African nations, for example, the lack of access to equipment such as ventilators, doctors, and other forms of healthcare is a huge dilemma, and one that requires the lenders to waive their fees, hence allowing such nations to concentrate on treating and defeating the virus. When one looks at the current spending on fighting the coronavirus, never more has there been such a time to demand that lenders provide some notion of debt relief to such nations. The average spending in sub-Saharan Africa on fighting the virus is around 0.26% of the GDP, when compared to Europe's 9% and North America's 11.5%, it's significantly lower than needed, raising the question as to just where the money is going otherwise. So what's being done to relieve the debt and reduce poverty? As things stand, out of the world's 28 poorest nations, 27 of them are in sub-Saharan Africa, with the region's poverty rating standing at around 42.3%, proving beyond doubt that African nations need debt alleviation. One such solution to the problem is a standstill on the interest being paid out. For many nations, the debt never gets repaid, as the interest on the debt outweighs the initial loan. Providing lenders are willing to waive the interest, the situation could be controlled. Yet as we all know, the chances of this happening are very low, hence why the rich remain rich and the poor remain poor.
Joining me in the studio today is our journalist and researcher, Atefe Padidar. Atefe, many thanks for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So I know that many poor nations in the world had already been under severe debts to global institutions and banks before the pandemic hit. And now with coronavirus showing no sign of abating, they are getting more and more indebted to them.
Right. That's what a lot of people on social media were expressing concern about. Like this tweet that I picked up. This one is from one campaign. It says, "This big key COVID-19 facts from Africa. 6 months extension of debt service suspension initiative. 65% of countries participating in the DSSI are African. 170 countries have implemented some form of lockdown."
What is DSSI?
Debt service suspension initiative. These countries have to enforce a lot of restrictions and lockdowns that put their businesses in slow motion or in total shutdown, and this had put their interest, they lagged behind their payments, and they couldn't pay their debt to, for example, IMF or World Banks. This is by Global Justice Now Scotland says, "The World Bank and the IMF have for decades been part of a well-orchestrated scheme to keep previously colonized countries in a never-ending cycle of debt." So this means that previously there were other ways of colonization, and now this is a modern way.
Modern way of that, yeah. Thank you so much, Atefe, for being with us here today again.
Thank you.
Hopefully we'll see you again next time in our show. Well, let's now take a look at how foreign direct investment into developing nations can come as both a blessing and a curse.
One of the most contentious topics when it comes to Africa is the notion of foreign direct investment. In a previous episode of Economic Divide, we discussed this issue, having looked at the Chinese economic investment into Africa. But the question that needs to be asked is whether FDI is a good or a bad thing. There's no doubt that FDI has some amazingly positive results when it comes to Africa. For a start, many African economies have grown over the last decade due to such money being invested into the nations, with investment into natural resources being a key part in the growth, with some 70% of expansion coming from this alone. But with such investment coming from foreign nations, there's a bad side to the equation, namely the opportunity for exploitation, with the lack of creation of jobs being one major factor, as much of the continent sees youth unemployment rates at around 50 to 60%, meaning that many African nations are left in a status quo that's hard to escape from. But there's also an ugly side to FDI, with corruption playing a huge part in the act, with several issues playing a part in how FDI is invested into Africa. The first is the notion that bribes have to be paid by foreign investors to gain access to niche African markets. This is something that may in fact dissuade investment into the continent. Secondly, corruption increases uncertainty, partly due to a lack of regulatory bodies fighting the corruption, and the notion that even if a bribe is paid, there's still no guarantee that a foreign investor will gain access to the market or resource. There are of course many other negative issues, but there are also some positive effects of such corruption. For one, bribes can, for example, reduce the bureaucratic paperwork involved in foreign direct investment. It can also skip inspections, taxes, and even play a part in government funding for the foreign entity. However, at the end of the day, many scholars agree that the notion of FDI is something that on the surface may appear good, yet often should be something that African nations, for one, should approach with an air of caution.
They should be careful, and in practice, there tends to be quite a big difference between foreign direct investment that's going into the resource sector, like mining, oil, that type of sector, and foreign direct investment that's going into manufacturing or, you know, services like financial services, tourism. The latter type of private sector investment is generally good and beneficial.
There's a very clear reason why the rich remain rich and the poor remain poor. And this is clearly seen in the case of rich nations lending to poor nations, hence keeping them in the status quo of being forever in debt. Is it then fair that the global north has such dominance over the global south, especially in times of crises, when people are dying and fair access to medical equipment is something that should be the norm? Yet, when one takes it a layer deeper still, the exploitation continues far beyond that, with Western imposed sanctions, for example, having a detrimental effect on the medical supplies of countries under sanctions, proving that the grip of the rich is nothing more than a method of exploitation statecraft in order to maintain their places at the top. That's about all the time we have for this episode. I've been Omid Roshandel, and on behalf of myself and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
In the limelight.
World Health Organization's European Regional Director Hans Kluge said in a meeting with European health ministers, Europe is at the epicenter of this coronavirus pandemic once again. Hans Kluge added, at the risk of sounding alarmist, I must express a very real concern. Kluge said that deaths have increased by more than 30% in the past week, and hospitalizations have reached their highest level since spring. Meanwhile, daily COVID-19 cases in the United States reached a record high on Thursday, 29th of October, with experts warning the death rate could triple by mid-January. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, there were almost 88,521 new cases of the coronavirus reported in the United States on Thursday, 29th of October, 9,540 more cases than on previous day, Wednesday, 28th of October. In total, there have been about 8,944,934 cases and at least 228,656 deaths in the United States, 971 of those deaths on Thursday. Moreover, the British government will close the furlough scheme in near future, with redundancies rising at the fastest rate on record and the second wave of COVID-19 pushing Britain's economy to the brink of a double-dip recession. As the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, prepares to end the multi-billion pound coronavirus job retention scheme and launch a less generous replacement program. Early warning indicators show business activity faltering as local lockdowns take effect. The article you're about to hear has been written by staff at The Guardian newspaper, as well as the Associated Press news agency, under the heading, Europe, US, again epicenter of coronavirus pandemic, it pushing UK to brink of double dip recession. Please stay with us for more. The 53-country region that makes up Europe under the umbrella of the World Health Organization, WHO, said it reached a record of confirmed cases of COVID-19 with 1.5 million new infections last week. The organization's European director said recently there have been more than 10 million confirmed cases since the pandemic began this year. According to Associated Press, the World Health Organization European Regional Director Hans Kluger said in a meeting with European health ministers, Europe is at the epicenter of this pandemic once again. At the risk of sounding alarmist, I must express our very real concern. Kluger said that deaths have increased by more than 30% in the past week, and hospitalizations have reached the highest level since spring. Explaining that testing systems have been unable to keep up with the influx, Hans Kluger said, test positivity levels have reached new highs. In addition to what is typically considered part of Europe, the World Health Organization's European division includes Russia, as well as Central Asian countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, and Turkmenistan in the 53-country count. Despite the increase in cases, Hans Kluger said, nationwide lockdowns should be viewed as a last resort. He cited the economic toll and effect on mental health as his reasoning behind keeping countries open. Several European countries have begun to take restrictive measures to curb the spread of the virus, including in Germany, the Irish Republic, and France, which have all implemented shutdowns. Kluger warned last month that infections were spreading faster than they were in March and should serve as a wake-up call for everyone. Meanwhile, daily COVID-19 cases in the United States reached a record high on Thursday, 29th of October, with experts warning the death rates could triple by mid-January. According to data from Johns Hopkins University, there were almost 88,521 new cases of the coronavirus reported in the United States on Thursday, 29th of October, 9,540 more cases than the previous day, Wednesday, 28th of October. In total, there have been 8,944,934 cases and at least 228,656 deaths in the United States, 971 of those deaths on Thursday. Dr. Scott Gottlieb, the former commissioner of the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, said during an interview on CNBC's Squawk Box recently, "This is the hardest point in this pandemic right now, the next 2 months. We can't give up our guard right now." The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington School of Medicine said it is more likely that by the middle of January, 2,250 Americans will be dying every day from the coronavirus, 3 times more than the current rate, and it could even get worse. The Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at the University of Washington said in its latest forecast, if states do not react to rising numbers by reimposing mandates, cumulative deaths could reach 514,000 by the same date. The fall winter surge should lead to a daily death toll that is approximately 3 times higher than now by mid-January. Hospitals, particularly ICUs, intensive care units, are expected to be under extreme stress in December and January in 18 states in the United States. According to the COVID tracking project, hospitals are already under increased strain. As of Thursday, 29th of October, more than 46,000 people were hospitalized, with all but 11 states seeing a rise in hospitalizations this week. Moreover, according to Johns Hopkins University, 43 states have shown an increase in cases compared to last week, with 5 holding steady and 2, Oklahoma and Louisiana, reporting a decline. New Mexico reported 1,082 new coronavirus cases on Thursday, a record, and a top healthcare executive there sounded the alarm bell about the direction of COVID-19 spread in New Mexico. Dr. Jason Mitchell said, "We are at an unsustainable growth rate." Dr. Mitchell is the chief medical officer at Presbyterian Healthcare Services, which operates 9 regional hospitals in New Mexico. Dr. Jason Mitchell said the state's rate of case growth is averaging about 5% a day, which would result in catastrophic numbers if there is no effort to change the trend. Dr. Mitchell said during a state health briefing, "By December, we would have so many cases that we would be in MASH or Mobile Army Surgical Hospital tents." The state of Illinois also reported a daily high of new COVID-19 cases for the second time in a week, with about 6,363 new cases on Thursday, 29th of October. According to the Illinois Department of Public Health, the total number of COVID-19 cases statewide now stands at 395,458. The governor of Illinois, J.B. Pritzker, announced that Region 3 would go into COVID-19 mitigation measures. 9 of the state's 11 regions now are under resurgence mitigation measures due to the high average positivity rates of COVID-19 cases. Minnesota, North Dakota, and Ohio also reported their highest daily COVID-19 totals on Thursday, with 2,872, 1,222, and 3,590 new positive cases, respectively. Meanwhile, according to the British newspaper The Guardian, the British government will close the furlough scheme this weekend, with redundancies rising at the fastest rate on record, and a second wave of COVID-19 pushing Britain's economy to the brink of a double-dip recession. As the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, prepares to end the multi-billion pound coronavirus job retention scheme and launch a less generous replacement programme, early warning indicators show business activity faltering as local lockdowns take effect. The number of people losing their jobs is rising much faster than during the 2008 financial crisis, whilst the economic fight back from the March lockdown is gradually fading. Faced with official forecasts that suggest unemployment could hit the highest level since the 1980s by Christmas, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, was forced into unveiling a last-minute package for business and workers amid anger over lack of state support as a number of new infections rose rapidly. Writing in The Guardian, the Conservative peer David Young, who was Employment Secretary in the second Thatcher government, said people were losing their jobs through no fault of their own and yet have the skills and energy to flourish when conditions return to normal. David Young urged Rishi Sunak to develop new measures to spur job creation. Lord Young said the situation today was different from that in the 1980s, when he said old industries needed to change, but added that help was needed fast. He said the longer people are out of work, the harder it is to get back to employment. Since the outset of the pandemic, The Guardian has chosen 8 economic indicators, as well as the level of the FTSE 100 index, to track the impact on jobs and growth from COVID-19 and the measures used to contain it. Faced with the deepest global recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s, the COVID Crisis Watch also monitors how the United Kingdom is faring compared with other countries. In the past month, official figures show that the United Kingdom economic growth slowed in August despite the government's Eat Out to Help Out scheme, providing a shot in the arm for the struggling hospitality industry. Business activity has since continued to slow at the start of autumn as the number of COVID infections rises and local lockdowns are imposed. In a bright spot for the British economy, this month's dashboard, retail sales have remained resilient as UK consumers, who saved money whilst working from home earlier this year, increased their spending on DIY or do-it-yourself and garden products. House prices have also risen at the fastest rate in 4 years, as people able to afford buying a property reassess their living conditions after lockdown. However, the latest dashboard shows problems are mounting for the economy as a difficult winter draws near. The latest figures from the Office of National Statistics, ONS, show that the number of redundancies almost doubled to 227,000 in the 3 months to August as the British government started to scale back the furlough scheme and the pandemic fallout forced companies to cut jobs. Headline unemployment rate also increased by the most in a decade to 4.5%, up from 4.1% in July. The Office for Budget Responsibility, the government's economic forecaster, has warned that the jobless rate could hit 12%, about 4 million people out of work, before the end of 2020. As the furlough scheme ends on Saturday, 24th of October, when it is replaced by the Less Generous Job Support Scheme, or JSS, the Office for National Statistics said almost 1 in 13 UK workers were still in receipt of wage subsidies from the state, about 2 million people. Against the backdrop of rising unemployment and tougher restrictions across large parts of Northern England, as well as in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales, Rishi Sunak has come under increasing pressure to provide further emergency support. The Job Support Scheme, or JSS, will offer workers two-thirds of their wages rather than 80% under furlough. Whilst there are also tougher eligibility criteria for businesses, local leaders and rebellious Conservative MPs representing northern constituencies have called for further financial assistance to protect shuttered businesses in their areas. In a message to the Chancellor, Lord Young, who was an advisor to David Cameron, said the government urgently needed to use state-backed job creation schemes to boost employment opportunities and help people start a business. Lord Young said government should now, for time is very much of the essence, recreate the programs that worked so well in the past, market them actively and encourage those newly out of work to get together either by themselves or with friends or colleagues and set up their own new businesses.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته Greetings and welcome Thank you guys for joining us to Youth Station With you today is Brother Habib and Brother Mahdi Brother, السلام عليكم
السلام.
Co-host, what's up? How y'all doing?
Chilling
Alright Now brother, some people are, you know, asking Telling me, ordering me Like the producer
Yeah
Who are you? What are you? What are you doing here? Are you a human?
Yeah, I used to study business, but then...
Where?
London.
London?
Yeah.
But so like that Barclays kind of guy, you know? You're not from Liverpool, you're not a Scouser.
Yeah, I'm more of a nature species person. Well, I mean, something switched, clicked, and I'm here right now, and we're studying philosophy and jurisprudence and stuff like that. You know, just the regular stuff.
The regular stuff. It's not regular, man. It's like Muhammad. Now, brother, you know, we come from different, you know, backgrounds and whatnot. What kind of people are you interested in? This is the topic, actually, today. That's our topic. What are you interested in? What do Muslims youth... we're going to go elaborate then later on, inshallah. What are Muslim youth into nowadays? I just want to ask you personally. What are you into? Like people.
People?
You know, what kind of people you like? Hanging out, you know, studying.
That's actually a very interesting question that you asked me. You know why? Now, it's so different. When you meet the same people that you used to be with, say, like before you were here, you don't find something that's very common now to chat with, for example. So, I'm interested in people that I can actually have a dialogue and benefit from that dialogue.
Oh, so you know? You're looking for benefits. In academic, you know, academically speaking, all right? You're looking for academic benefits. But if I ask you for example, a friend, and you say, I'm looking for benefits, then I would say that you're, you know... And now, me personally, I kind of differ. Like, the person, love, I like this kind of type. And for, you know, business, I like this kind of type. And for, you know, altogether a friend, I like this kind of type. Or study mate, I like this kind of type. For example, like in my... as a business person, when I do my own businesses, I like the person to always be upfront.
Yeah, with the cash.
No, not upfront with the cash. Upfront with his personality. Doesn't hide anything. I like the person to be transparent. For example, if I'm giving him a job, I don't want him to be like in front of me, oh yes, that's nice, and then turn his back and like, oh, I have to do this. I have to work like this. Mm-hmm. No, I want a person... I want to understand this person is enjoying his job or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And for example, if I'm working with someone, I want that person to tell me, I like your work. I don't want that person to lie to me and telling me, I like your work or I don't like your work. I want that person to tell me the truth. I want a transparent person.
Yeah, transparency and honesty is something
and that's
that
in business.
In.
For example, in class, academics, of course, I have to have someone that's smarter than me. I always look for someone that's smarter than me. Alhamdulillah, there are a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not few, you know. There are a lot.
Yeah,
but I'm not on the dim side.
I wish it was the same for me.
But anyways, that I always look for a smarter person that I could always learn from, especially with experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, but that, you know, that's us living now in Hausa. You know, like how we stated, we changed.
Yeah, you're right.
Your first year. Yeah. How many years have you been studying here?
Five.
5 years. I've been studying here for like 11 years, 10 years.
No way.
Right. And so I've changed a lot since I've seen a lot of people. I've seen a lot of, you know, different role models. I've changed a lot of, you know, Hausa role models and whatnot. And I learned from it. And I changed a lot. And I'm not like in the beginning where I want to know people. I want to get rid of people out of my life sometimes.
This actually, I don't know if you'd agree with me or not, but like once you're here, it's more than people now. Like, what you choose is specific traits, and those traits could be anyone.
Yeah.
So, like, you're more of a traits person, not a people person. For example, like, you know, back in the West, you'd be a diehard fan of a celebrity.
Yeah.
And whatever they do, you try to justify it. Yeah. Justify that, you know? But over here, it's a bit different, isn't it? Like, you're more of a trait and action person. Like, you like those actions and those traits.
Yeah. You look for the. I think not only here. I think that everywhere. The more you grow, the more you understand. Mm-hmm. This is not a good friend. This is not a good companion. This is not a good businessman, a business friend. I think that the more we grow, the more we learn, the more the things that we understand we need. And you know, it's not only about laughing and joking someone that could bring, you know, that happiness of laughing and joking to you. No. There has to be benefits. There also has to be benefits. They could benefit you. They could comfort you. They could, you know, help you out during the hard times. We have this al-sadiq and al-dhiq, an Arabic example of a friend is where as during is known during harsh or tough situations. And Muslims, unfortunately, in the West are like the rest of the youths around the world. And that is that when they enter their lives, they enter their lives in school, and the only thing that they want to do in school is not study, and anyone that brings happiness and makes them laugh or someone that's cool or popular, they want to follow.
We had an economics teacher, and he used to say this, that when you don't study and you're by yourself, that makes you feel alone. But when you've got a friend who doesn't study with you, then you're all right with that, you know? That mate takes you back. So just a mate, that's a person who actually lets you know what's wrong with you.
That's a big benefit. We have that in the saying as well. It states that my best companions may Allah have mercy on those who show me my ayub or my who show me my defects, you know, things, my faults. Yeah, he shows me my faults, actually. And that's a true friend. And he doesn't, embarrass you in front of everyone and tells your faults in front of everyone. No. Mm-hmm. He takes you away. He tells you, I am advising you. This is good. You're doing this. You're doing bad. And that really comes from the love that they have towards you, relationship that they have towards you. Because a person with envy towards you won't tell you you're doing something wrong. He wants you to continue doing it wrong.
Well, jealousy, for example. Yeah. So this goes on, doesn't it? Like, for example, if we don't have mates, and if we don't choose mates to actually let us know what we do wrong, this goes on to become an entire society that does not stop in the face of oppression.
Yeah.
And whatever's going on, go on. And if we choose these people around us, then the entire society has an impact on that.
There's also something here that I've personally learned, and that is sometimes when your parents talk to you, they're talking to you from love. So when they advise you, when they advise you about something, how to pick your friends, or for example, they tell you, I don't like that friend or I don't like that friend, we take that sometimes personal. We hate that kind of advice that they give us. Don't talk to that person. Because most of the times, like how you said most, I'm not going to say all of the times, these adults, our parents, they understand what a friend should be. Because they had this experience, they went through it. After, like, for example, your father, for example, 35, and you're 50, oh, I'm not gonna say you're 40, he's 40 and you're 15. He's been through so much. He's seen a lot of people. I'm pretty sure, like, hundreds of people. He's lived with hundreds of people, especially if you're Arab, and you're living in Arab land. You've seen hundreds of people. You've seen different kinds of people, different kinds of cultures. He knows what kind of friend you need, especially with your own personality. What kind of friend is a true friend?
That's actually true with wives, isn't it? Your parents might be able to tell which kind of...
I personally think this boyfriend-girlfriend thing is kind of, stupid. Actually, you always have to know before marriage. I personally believe that you're not going to know anyone except you live with them. And when are you going to live with them? When you're married. So I think that love before marriage, it's a fantasy. It's not a reality. Say, it's like how you're, like how we stated that you should know what kind of person you're interested in marriage. For example, a talaba or a student, for example, his interest in a woman might differ to a person who is a businessman.
Yeah.
It might differ.
Yeah, the businessman wants a mathematician as a wife, for example.
Or, for example, a person who is living in this country or from this culture. He wants this kind of person or interested in this kind of person.
But that doesn't close the door to get to know people,
Of course, In this topic, me personally speaking, you get hurt so much, you see so much, betrayal, you get tired of it. So you just want to, just finish off your life and continue your life. You want to do what you want to do. You want to reach your own goal. To reach your own goal, sometimes you have to stay away from people. And that, unfortunately, is the case. And, you lose sometimes interest in, the celebrities, the football players, the heroes that you had when you were younger. Why? Because of your goal. You grow up, you understand that you have to fulfill your goal. You want to fulfill your goal. You feel empty without fulfilling your goal. Then you understand that I'm not going to be able to fulfill my goal if I'm running after my friends or if I'm running after these celebrities and I'm just following this football match and that football match.
Well, that's actually,
of course,
when
I'm
you said
a hard Liverpool fan, of course.
You still are.
Still are.
I don't know how it's phrased in Arabic, but like a friend is a person who reminds you, whose face reminds you of God.
Oh yeah, whenever you sit of course the saying is about the person with knowledge, the true person who holds knowledge. Whenever someone sits with him, he reminds him of the Creator, of course.
Like, so if that's with friends, that's mind blowing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, you're by yourself, and you're more cautious, and you're more remembering
with that person than by yourself.
By yourself.
That's very rare. Unfortunately, that's very rare. You know, we say that we want to do this and we want to, you know, be that kind of friend or have that kind of friend. But when it comes to, you know, actually having that kind of friend, sometimes we don't like it. Why? Because we see ourselves limited and regulated a lot. Now, I want to ask you this, my brother. Nowadays, what are the youth more interested in? You know, I'm not a youth no more. I'm an old person. Look at my white hair. Look at my gray hair.
Part of the light.
The youth, are they interested in celebrities, football players? What makes what makes these youth interested in that person?
What I've seen so far is someone who's made money at a young age. That's what most of the people in the West are.
Money talks.
Yeah, they're leaning towards that a bit. Yeah, but there are some people who are actually interested in intelligence. For example, Tesla, Elon Musk. People are a bit towards that as well, only if they understood true intelligence.
Yeah. So there are like these desires that they see that, I don't know, I'm trying to make it like, it might sound mystic and whatnot, but like they see that,
brace
you
yourselves.
Know, perfection. They think that this is the perfection that I desire. So I'm interested in that perfection. Thus, when I think that this person obtains or has that kind of perfection, I run after him. I follow him. I like him. I'm interested in him. Because I think that perfection is what I want, what I need, and what he has.
Yeah, if that's perfection in the first place.
Exactly. And I've read this in Reddit, actually. You know Reddit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I've read this question. What makes a person... it was like a blog about how one's state of mind changes about who thinks is smart and who's dumb. And what makes a dumb person look smart? And
is that how a you question? Understand. Was that a question?
Ask Reddit, actually.
Yeah,
and then one of the answers was very nice. It's like, a lot of people, when you grow up, you start to understand they're talking, you know, a lot of rubbish, actually. They're not it's not true intelligence. They're just speaking out of what they desire and what they want.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the more you grow, the more you understand, like, oh, yeah, that's not the perfection.
That's so true. Even the same people that you used to be with,
yeah,
when you were a child, and you realize, for example, for me, it's my parents. So many times as a child, I used to think that what they're saying is not sensible.
And you grow up, you understand this is the most sensible thing that I've heard in my life.
You know, and the older I get, the more I realize that they're actually smart people.
They know what they're talking about.
Yeah,
they know what they're talking about. Yeah, unfortunately, we also the opposite with friends. Like, for example, this person's telling you, this is the right thing, and then you follow them, and you grow up like, oh man, they were wrong.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, same as when it was after O levels that we had to choose the fields. Someone convinced me to go to finance, and
you're not a good mathematician. you're not good at math. So anyway, I think it's important for our youth and us, especially, even we're in this path anyway, that our life. Every breath we take, like how Imam Hussein alayhi salam stated, every breath we take away is a part of us that's never coming back.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not coming back. And why should we waste it and change the road or path of our life because we failed to take true advice? So I think that we should look for who gives true advice and then really take that advice.
If we take advice in the first place, you know, like we have to get this habit.
Then we have to take it. You know? It's two stages, actually, two tough stages. Brothers and sisters, I hope you guys enjoyed the show. You guys were listening to Youth Station, where today we were talking about, you know, our personal interest. Who are we interested in? Like I said, I'm interested in good-looking people because I'm good-looking, you know? Anyway, from me and my brother Mehdi, we're signing off. Till another show. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
My love. My life, my days, my nights, my wealth, my prayers are for you. Now I know how it's like to have your precious love in my life. Now I know how it feels to finally be at peace inside. I wish that everybody knew how amazing the to love you. I wish that everyone could see how your love has set me free and made
strong.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. President Donald Trump embarked on a blistering final campaign sprint on Sunday, 1st of November, lining up 10 rallies in 7 swing states over 2 days in an effort to defy the opinion polls and replicate his shock election win in 2016. As he did so, it was reported that he's planning to declare victory on Tuesday, before the results are called. Citing 3 anonymous sources familiar with his private comments, the news website Axios said Donald Trump has told confidants that he'll declare victory on Tuesday night if it looks like he's ahead. The article you're about to hear has been written by Guardian columnist Julian Borger and Martin Pengelly. The piece is titled, Trump Says He's Preparing for Legal Challenges to Vote Counts as final sprint begins. Stay with us for more of Julian Borger and Martin Pengelly's article. Donald Trump embarked on a blistering final campaign sprint on Sunday, 1st of November, lining up 10 rallies in 7 swing states over 2 days in an effort to defy the opinion polls and replicate his shock election win in 2016. As he did so, it was reported that he's planning to declare victory on Tuesday, before the official results are announced. Citing 3 anonymous sources familiar with his private comments, the news website Axios said Donald Trump has told confidants that he'll declare victory on Tuesday night if it looks like he's ahead. That's even if the Electoral College outcome still hinges on large numbers of uncounted votes in key states, such as Pennsylvania. Axios added, Trump has privately talked through his scenario in some detail in the last few weeks, describing plans to walk up to a podium on election night and declare that he has won. For this to happen, his allies expect he would need to either win or have commanding leads in many states like Ohio, Florida, North Carolina, Texas, Iowa, Arizona, and Georgia. President Trump has denied the Axios story, describing it as false, but then confirmed he would try to shut down vote counting as soon as the polls close on Tuesday, 3rd of November. I don't think it's fair that we have to wait for a long time after the election, the president told journalists in North Carolina. as soon as the election is over, we're going in with our lawyers. Asked about the Axios report, Donald Trump's Democratic challenger Joe Biden said, "My response is that the president's not going to steal this election." According to 538.com, Donald Trump leads in Ohio, Texas, and Iowa, whilst Joe Biden leads in Florida, North Carolina, Georgia, and Arizona. The races are all exceptionally tight. The biggest lead in the 538.com polling average is Joe Biden by 3 percentage points in Arizona. The smallest lead is Donald Trump by 0.2 percentage point in Ohio. Under the coronavirus pandemic, early and mail-in voting has reached unprecedented levels, fueling expectations of record turnout, but also fears that many states will take longer than usual to count their ballots. Donald Trump's tactics, according to the Axios website, will depend on continuing to claim without evidence that ballots counted after Election Day are illegitimate and evidence of voter fraud. Vote counting after Election Day is a regular feature of U.S. elections, of course. In another twist on the campaign trail, the FBI confirmed on Sunday that it was investigating an incident in which a convoy of vehicles flying Donald Trump flags surrounded a bus carrying campaign staff for Democratic challenger Joe Biden on a Texas highway. FBI San Antonio in Texas is aware of the incident and investigating it, Special Agent Michelle Lee, a spokeswoman for the Federal Bureau of Investigation in San Antonio, told Reuters news agency in an email. No further information is available at this time. Many of Donald Trump's claims about alleged fraud have focused on Pennsylvania, where the race is close, but where votes counted after 3rd of November are expected to favor the Democratic challenger Joe Biden, who leads most national and battleground polls. Both candidates campaigned heavily in the state this weekend. "Pennsylvania is critical to this election," Joe Biden told a drive-in rally in Philadelphia on Sunday evening, describing the president as an obstacle to defeating the coronavirus pandemic. "To beat the virus, we first got to beat Donald Trump," Biden said. "He's the virus." Democrats have long worried that Trump will declare victory early, aiming to sow uncertainty and legal battles over ballots and results. Some observers have called the tactic the Red Mirage, which former Housing Secretary Julian Castro said this week sounds like a supervillain and is just as insidious. On election night, 3rd of November, there's a real possibility that the data will show Republicans leading early, before all the votes are counted, Castro said. "Then they can pretend something sinister is going on when the counts change in Democrats' favor." On Sunday, on CNN's State of the Union, an advisor to Joe Biden, Anita Dunn, said she thought the victor would be known sometime on 4th of November, the day after the election. A lot of the early states that are battleground states, especially in the Sun Belt, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, are states that tend to get their votes counted on election night, Anita Dunn said. "I think we will get some sort of indicator what kind of night it's going to be from those three states. We will see. Obviously, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin may be slower to count their vote." The Pennsylvania official in charge of elections, Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar, a Democrat, told NBC's Meet the Press, "There could be 10 times as many mail-in ballots than in 2016. She added, "I expect that the overwhelming majority of ballots in Pennsylvania, that's mail-in and absentee ballots, as well as in-person ballots, will be counted within a matter of days." Axios says that Donald Trump campaign was bullish about key states, including Texas, Nevada, North Carolina, Arizona, and Wisconsin. On ABC's This Week, Trump advisor Jason Miller claimed, "If you speak with many smart Democrats, they believe President Trump will be ahead on election night, probably getting 280 electoral votes somewhere in that range, and then they're going to try to steal it back after the election. We believe that will be over 290 electoral votes on election night, so no matter what they try to do, what kind of hijinks or lawsuits or whatever kind of nonsense they try to pull off, we're still going to have enough electoral votes to get President Trump re-elected. Jason Miller's claim rested on the idea that all ballots must be counted on election day, a legal and political nonsense. Nonetheless, the Trump campaign communications director, Tim Murtaugh, told Axios website, when he wins, he's going to say so. Donald Trump's final 2020 tour, which began on Sunday 1st of November in Michigan, is aimed at holding states he won 4 years ago and shoring up support in traditional Republican strongholds like North Carolina and Georgia. Joe Biden was due to hold two drive-in meetings in Pennsylvania, one of a string of former Democratic bastions in the Northeast, which Donald Trump won from Hillary Clinton by less than a percentage point. New opinion polls showed Joe Biden holding on to a lead in Pennsylvania. The New York Times and Siena College gave the Democrat a 6 percentage point edge, whilst the Washington Post and ABC News showed a 7 percentage point margin. In Michigan, Donald Trump repeated some of the messages that worked in 2016, highlighting the impact of globalization on the car industry. "I gave you a lot of auto plants, so I think we're even," he told a crowd at a wind and rain swept rally in Washington. One new car plant has been announced since Donald Trump took office, whilst Michigan automotive jobs had fallen by 2,400 even before the COVID-19 pandemic. Employment in the sector is down more than 18,000 in the state, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Donald Trump's other principal line of attack was to warn voters that Joe Biden would implement a drastic lockdown that will kill jobs. The president has insisted the nation has turned the corner despite record numbers of new COVID-19 cases across the country and warnings of a spike in deaths over the winter. Trump insisted on holding mass rallies with no social distancing, at which very few people wear face masks. A study by Stanford University in California estimated that at least 30,000 coronavirus infections and 700 deaths caused by 18 Trump rallies between June and September. "We're in for a lot of hurt," Anthony Fauci, the country's leading expert on infectious diseases, told the Washington Post. "It's not a good situation. All the stars are aligned in the wrong place. As you go into the fall and winter season with people congregating at home indoors, you could not possibly be positioned more poorly." NBC and Wall Street Journal opinion poll on Sunday put Joe Biden 10 points up, a majority of voters saying they were unhappy with President Trump's handling of the pandemic and the direction that the country is taking. The same opinion poll 4 years ago had Hillary Clinton up, but only by 4 percentage points. In 2016, there were many more undecided and third-party voters. The Trump camp has stepped up signals that they will look to Republican-leaning courts to cast doubt on the integrity of the enormous volume of postal ballots. In Texas, a federal court will hear a lawsuit on Monday aimed at having 117,000 votes in Houston thrown out because they were cast at curbside ballot boxes set up to make voting easier during the pandemic, which the Republican plaintiffs argue was illegal. The Texas Supreme Court has twice rejected a similar argument, but a federal court in Houston, Texas, has agreed to hear the case. Meanwhile, speaking to reporters on Sunday evening, 1st of November, President Trump denied that he would declare victory prematurely. He added, "I think it's a terrible thing when ballots can be collected after an election. I think it's a terrible thing when states are allowed to tabulate ballots for a long period of time after the election is over." Trump added, "I think it's terrible that we can't know the result of an election the night of the election. We're going to go into the night of, as soon as the elections are over, we're going in with our lawyers." We don't want to have Pennsylvania, where you have a political governor, a very partisan guy. We don't want to be in a position where he's allowed every day to watch ballots come in. See if we can